This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The bulletin about an unusual series of explosions on the planet Mars was just the opening volley of the War of the Worlds. Over the next hour, an increasingly disturbed radio audience heard news of strange developments in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, where what first appeared to be a meteorite spewed a horde of aliens who proceeded to unleash death rays and poison gas. Oh, the humanity. On this 65th anniversary of that broadcast, we'll listen in on a recreation of the most infamous radio show ever, and we'll talk about hoaxes, including whether the War of the Worlds was won or not. If you have questions or examples of tall tales and wondrous discoveries that have fooled mankind through the ages, the Cottingley fairies maybe, jackalopes, or the collapse of the Wisconsin State House in 1933, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or send us an email, TOTN@NPR.org. But first, we return to the night of October 30th, 1938. The strains of Ramon Racello and his orchestra have already been interrupted with news updates from Grover's Mills. Joining us from our bureau in nearby New York are a couple of actors from the City Theater Company who are ready to take us live to the Princeton Observatory, where commentator Carl Phillips is with famous astronomer Richard Pearson. And we take you now to Princeton, New Jersey.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
This is Carl Phillips speaking to you from the observatory at Princeton. I'm standing in a large semicircular room, pitch black except for an oblong split in the ceiling. Through this opening, I can see a sprinkling of stars that cast a kind of frosty glow over the intricate mechanism of the huge telescope. The ticking sound you hear is the vibration of the clockwork. Professor Pearson stands directly above me on a small platform, peering through a giant lens. I ask you to be patient, ladies and gentlemen, during any delay that may arise during our interview. Besides his ceaseless watch of the heavens, Professor Pearson may be interrupted by telephone or other communications. During this period, he is in constant touch with the astronomical centers of the world. Professor, may I begin our questions?
At any time, Mr. Phillips.
Professor, would you please tell our radio audience exactly what you see as you observe the planet Mars through your telescope?
Nothing unusual at the moment, Mr. Phillips. A red disk swimming in a blue sea. Transverse stripes across the disk, quite distinct now because Mars happens to be at the point nearest the Earth, in opposition, as we call it.
In your opinion, what do these transverse stripes signify, Professor Pearson?
Not canals, I can assure you, Mr. Phillips. Although that's the popular conjecture of those who imagine Mars to be inhabited. From a scientific viewpoint, the stripes are merely the result of atmospheric conditions peculiar to the planet.
Then you're quite convinced, as a scientist, that living intelligence as we know it does not exist on Mars?
I'd say the chances against it are 1,000 to 1.
And yet, how do you account for those gas eruptions occurring on the surface of the planet at regular intervals?
Mr. Phillips, I cannot account for it.
By the way, Professor, for the benefit of our listeners, how far is Mars from the Earth?
Approximately 40 million miles.
Well, that seems a safe enough distance.
Thank you.
Just a moment, ladies and gentlemen. Someone has just handed Professor Pearson a message. While he reads it, let me remind you that we are speaking to you from the observatory in Princeton, New Jersey, where we are interviewing the world-famous astronomer, Professor Pearson. One moment, please. Professor Pearson has passed me a message which he has just received. Professor, may I read the message to the listening audience?
Certainly, Mr. Phillips.
Ladies and gentlemen, I shall read you a wire addressed to Professor Pearson from Dr. Gray of the National History Museum, New York. Quote, 9:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Seismograph registered a shock of almost earthquake intensity occurring within a radius of 20 miles of Princeton. Please investigate. Signed, Lloyd Gray, Chief of Astronomical Division. End quote. Professor Pearson, could this occurrence possibly have something to do with the disturbances observed on the planet Mars?
Hardly, Mr. Phillips. This is probably a meteorite of unusual size, and its arrival at this particular time is merely a coincidence. However, we shall conduct a search as soon as daylight permits.
Thank you, Professor. Ladies and gentlemen, for the past 10 minutes, we've been speaking to you from the observatory at Princeton, bringing you a special interview with Professor Pearson, noted astronomer. This is Carl Phillips speaking. We are returning you now to our New York studio.
Oh, radio news ain't what it used to be. Joining us now in our New York studio are actors Stephen Weber and Jeffrey Frasse of the City Theater Company, who performed an early scene from the Mercury Theater of the Air's War of the Worlds as a Halloween Eve treat for us. The City Company is performing War of the Worlds, the radio play, in venues around the East Coast this week, including tonight at the West Bank Cafe in Manhattan. And thanks very much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
Happy to be here.
To start with, we got to hear that segment over the air the way it was originally intended. How do you do it as a stage performance?
Oh, very much just like that. It is a theatrical performance, and so our set is a radio recording studio, and we are radio actors putting on this broadcast. And it's pretty much just microphones, some music stands with scripts, and that's our set.
And I'm just trying to keep track of the voices here. Is that Stephen Weber there?
That's Stephen Weber, yeah.
Oh, hi there. How do you keep the suspense for an audience that can not only see inside the illusion, but I think they know how the story comes out?
We build a secondary plot in there, and that is just how the Mercury Theater on the Air tells the story, what happened that night of October 30th, 1938. And ours is a fictitious imagining. Ours has Orson Welles coming in late, which actually did happen from time to time because he was engaged in so many rehearsals for other shows downtown, and he has changes to everybody's script, and so there's actually quite a lot of physical work, passing scripts, making changes. All what goes on off mic is what the audience in our theater is privy to.
Now, Stephen, what got you interested in what's actually, you know, we heard the clockwork ticking of the astronomy lab there, but a fairly old piece of radio drama?
Well, the City Company, which is based in New York but performs around the country and around the world, did a play about Orson Welles' life and his work. And as research for that, we thought we would do this radio play one night only, to give me a chance to live inside of Orson for a little bit, and also just as an extension of our research into his life and work. And it turns out that night was so wildly successful that 4 years later the radio play is still touring around and audiences are still interested in hearing it and seeing it.
Did they come for the War of the Worlds aspect of it, do you think, or just to, you know, it is a curiosity to see a radio play performed?
Well, I think it's a combination of interest in this as a historical event in American history, and also interest in the City Company and their work and their take on a historical event. Because we don't do it purely realistically. We have our own sort of staging and our own theatrical take on mm-hmm. what happened.
Well, we got an email about that broadcast. When I was a kid, writes Calvin Roach, I had an elderly aunt who told me she actually heard Orson Welles' broadcast. She was in her 30s at the time, but lived in a very rural area where news from outside was pretty rare. She told me how dozens of folks from around the area began to converge on churches with guns and hunting dogs to track down whatever was happening. Well, that's interesting. That is part of the legend of the War of the Worlds, that it led to a nationwide panic, and we're going to be talking more about that later. But one of the things it indubitably did was transfer Orson Welles from being a fairly well-known radio star to being a national celebrity.
That's right. He was a Broadway star, director and actor, and also a radio star, the voice of the Shadow, and well-known to, you know, all Americans, but that really catapulted him into his film career. Film studios had been making him offers, but not until War of the Worlds and this panic did they make him offers that he couldn't refuse, like really fantastic offers that led to the making of Citizen Kane.
Well, let's take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and hear a little bit of the original performance, this at the scene of the crash.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is terrific. This end of the thing is beginning to flake off. The top is beginning to rotate like a screw, and this thing must be hollow.
He's moving! Keep back there! Keep back there! Keep those men back! Keep those idiots back! Come on, get back! Speak off! The top's loose!
Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute.
That's the moment where, for those listeners who believed what they were hearing, the news report went beyond curiosity to serious menace. And, Stephen, did Welles, you know, hope to create that kind of impact on his audience?
He always said later that he knew that it would have an impact, but not the size of impact that it had. And I don't know if Orson is the best source of information about his own his own life. But, you know, if you believe that, he did have an idea of what was going to happen. He actually did not like this script, and he did not think it was going to be a successful show.
He didn't write it. Howard Koch did.
Yeah, Howard Koch wrote it, and when Howard showed it to he and John Houseman, who were running the Mercury Theater on the air, they were not happy with it, and they made a lot of changes. But they eventually decided to do it because they really didn't have anything that they were more excited about, and it was a kind of Halloween thing. So I think given that, it's a little suspicious to me when Orson says he knew that it was going to have an impact. I don't know if he did. No. Although they did work very hard to make it sound believable, even though it's hard for us to believe listening to that clip that people bought it. They did work very hard to sound like, you know, news broadcasts and cutting in and out of music and the reality of the thing was something they tried hard to create. So you'd think they'd had some hope that people might, you know, buy into it.
Let's get a phone call in now. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And we'll talk with Mike, who's with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi there. Yeah, this is a little bit close to the bone for me because I was living in Tucson in 1986, and a neighbor who lived five blocks away came to visit me, said, if you can be ready in a few minutes, I'll drive you to my place. Your parents are visiting with us there, and we'll have a nice reunion. And on the way over, he turned on the radio, and it started saying, this is not a test. This is not a test. The United States is under nuclear attack. Please turn to however many number it was, kilocycles, for details on what to do. And what it really was a documentary on what they would have played in the 50s had it happened. But he thought it was the real thing, and frankly, so did I. And after two long blocks, he said, had there been a telephone pole, you know, when we finally got aware that it was a documentary, because the commentator butted in, he said, had there been a telephone pole in the last two blocks, I would have ended it for both of us. But he didn't ask me first. And it also happened in a supermarket in 1968 in Ithaca, New York. It was somebody's psychology experiment in the 50s, and the station played it again just as a joke. And the whole store went into panic.
Well, I guess one of the things that Mike, you and your uncle may have missed was the opening of the broadcast. And Steve Weber, isn't that the case of a lot of the people who tuned in to the original broadcast? I mean, there were credits at the top. It was identified as the Mercury Radio Theater of the Air.
That's right. The Mercury Theater on the Air was at the same time as the Charlie McCarthy Hour, which was the most popular radio show in America. So everybody that night tuned in to hear Charlie McCarthy, but that night there was no Charlie McCarthy show. So they missed the beginning of the Mercury Theater show and heard the beginning of whatever replaced Charlie McCarthy, and because they weren't interested in that, they switched stations and listened to the Mercury Theater. And by the time they had switched over, they missed the fact that the disclaimer that said that this is not a real broadcast, and they bought it.
Well, the curious thing is that aside from War of the Worlds, many of us remember Orson Welles from a television ad saying that we will sell no wine before it's time. I gather one of the main things you're trying to do is recover his memory as an American artist.
That's exactly right. He was a great American artist, and he's more celebrated in Europe, and I think it's good to remember the, you know, artist that America has created, and somebody, frankly, who changed three mediums, radio, theater, and film.
Steven Weber, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Steven Weber and Jeffrey Frasse are actors with the City Theater Company, whose performance of War of the Worlds is on the road this week, and they joined us from the studios of our bureau in New York. Coming up, we move from aliens in New Jersey to petrified giants in New York, not to mention buffalo on the moon, and antlered rabbits in Montana. All of this when we discuss the great hoaxes of history after a short break. If you have a favorite bit of flim-flam you'd like to share with us, if you've ever been duped by a hoax, call us 800-989-8255 or send email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News.